Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Overshadowed by Iraq, the war in Afghanistan is too often forgotten. But for U.S. troops, it's every step as deadly. In the mountainous terrain of eastern Afghanistan, near the border with Pakistan's lawless frontier and Osama bin Laden's rumored hiding place, foot soldiers take fire by day and dig trenches by night. The enemy is close, the combat is old school. This hour, On Point, an American platoon in the war for Afghanistan. And joining me now from New York City is journalist and author Sebastian Younger. He's been embedded with the platoon of the 503rd Infantry Regiment in the Korangal Valley of Afghanistan. And his piece in the new issue of Vanity Fair is called Into the Valley of Death. Younger has been writing about Afghanistan since 1996. He's also the author of The Perfect Storm, The True Story of Men Against the Sea. Sebastian Younger, welcome to On Point.
Hi there. Thank you, Jackie.
A really vivid and intimate portrait of this platoon facing the most precarious of circumstances. You were with them for on and off 15 months?
No, they started their deployment in June, and I was with them in June, and then I went back in September with photographer Tim Hetherington, who I think you know is also in the studio with me today.
And he's going to be joining us shortly in a moment. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
and then Tim went back in October. So our idea is to track one platoon for their whole deployment. We can't realistically spend the entire 15 months with them, obviously. So we're going back and forth every 2 or 3 months just to check up on them. We spend about 3 weeks with them, and then we come home.
Tell me about your desire to try to portray what these men going through, what you had envisioned before you ever went to Afghanistan. And then I know you've had a long interest in the country. I'll ask you about that in a moment. But what were you envisioning before you even went there?
Well, a platoon is 30 men, and it's a small enough group that you can really get to know each individual pretty well, and therefore your reader can get to know them pretty well. And 15 months is it's an eternity in some ways. I mean, a lot can happen in 15 months. And this particular platoon, they're not stationed on an air base in Iraq. A lot of the troops, as tough as things are out in the streets of Baghdad, when they come back to their base, they have internet connection, they have television, satellite TV, they've got cafeteria, hot water. These guys are literally living in a sandbagged outpost on a remote hilltop, literally surrounded by the enemy, taking fire every day. And I just thought it was an extraordinary opportunity to watch a group of young men, very good soldiers, change over the course of their 15 months. And I was getting in on this at the very beginning of their deployment. I knew of this unit from 2 years earlier. I was embedded with Battle Company, and the 2nd Platoon is one of 4 platoons in Battle Company.
Mm-hmm.
In Zabul province. It was my first experience being embedded with U.S. forces.
Halfway and between Kabul and Kandahar.
Kandahar, that's mm-hmm. right. And I just thought they were extraordinary, extraordinary men. And when I heard that they were redeploying back to Afghanistan, I thought, oh, I've got to be part of this.
And so did you know Tim Hetherington? Let's bring in Tim Hetherington.
Hey, hi there, Jackie.
Hi there. You're the photographer for this story, Remarkable Pictures.
Yeah, I'm a photographer, filmmaker.
And a filmmaker. And did you two know one another before this assignment?
I think professionally we knew each other. We'd never worked together per se. But, really in this environment, professional environment, it's quite a small sort of shop, as it were. So I'd known Sebastian and his work. And so when we had the opportunity to work together, I think we both kind of thought that it would be a good idea.
Sebastian Younger, you have been interested in Afghanistan for a long time. You first went there in the mid-90s to profile Ahmad Shah Massoud, the Lion of Panjshir. Remind us who he was.
Actually, I had a couple of experiences in Afghanistan before 9/11. I was there in 96 to write about the Al-Qaeda training camps in Tora Bora. I was in Jalalabad and Kabul right before the Taliban swept through and took those cities and pretty much locked up the rest of the country except for a small corner in the northeast that was controlled by Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance. I went back in 2000. I spent a month and a half with Massoud as he was fighting a very, very heavy offensive against the Taliban. He was trying to open up his supply lines before winter set in. He was sort of the last hope of the Afghan government against the Taliban. And he was such an effective guerrilla fighter. He was an amazing military strategist that the Taliban, even though they outnumbered him 3-1, had a full supply of weaponry from Pakistan and intelligence operatives from Pakistan. They could not take him down. Mm-hmm. And he was killed 2 days before 9/11 as part of the 9/11 plot. And as soon as 9/11 happened, I started making my way back to Afghanistan. I was with the same Northern Alliance fighters I'd been with the year before when they took Kabul in November 2001.
So to some degree, you were accustomed to being with fighters. These have been Afghan fighters, but to being with fighters on mountain ridges in Afghanistan. And yet these American soldiers had a very different task, and the image of Americans in Afghanistan has changed a lot in the last 7 years, especially outside Kabul, has it not?
It has. And I mean, I should say that it's a very different experience. The fighting that I've been in, the combat that I've been in, is very, very different with the American soldiers than before. When I was with the Massoud's forces, one of the greatest terrors was artillery. The Taliban had a lot of it, and we just got hammered several times. It was an absolutely terrifying experience. The American soldiers are not really facing that kind of heavy artillery, that kind of heavy weaponry, which is a blessing. I mean, it's really the most terrifying experience I think I've ever had is being under bombardment. What they are facing, though, are very, very experienced fighters in very rough terrain, and we were getting ambushed constantly and very, very effectively. And but the American soldiers are so well trained, you feel a kind of security. You feel like, okay, we're getting shot at, but these guys know how to handle it. The Afghans, the attitude of the Afghans seems to have shifted a lot. I mean, when I got into Kabul in 2001 with the Northern Alliance, I was literally getting hugged on the street because I was American. The Afghans saw America as a kind of savior. Finally, someone was going to wade into this awful situation and put a stop to it. They'd been fighting for 20 years. And we really, there was immense gratitude on the streets of Kabul. That has shifted a bit. The war is, and we're now 6 years into the war. There have been a lot of civilian casualties, and there's a real weariness. And I wouldn't say that Afghans in general want us out of the country. I think they're terrified of that prospect. But certainly no one's getting hugged on the street mm-hmm. because they're American.
Tim, would you describe the Korangal Valley, where it is, why it's important, and who these villagers are? You have panoramic pictures of the valley in Vanity Fair.
Well, the valley is in Kunar province, as you stated before, towards the border with Afghanistan. The border's fairly, I mean, it's a
with
porous
Pakistan.
Border.
Mm-hmm.
Pakistan. And the border's porous. And the sort of strategic significance of the Korangal Valley is that it lies on a smuggling route that comes from Pakistan into Afghanistan. And if you follow the valleys across, eventually you get to the doorstep of Kabul. So strategically, for sort of Taliban fighters, for sort of foreign Islamic fighters, the valley is of significance. And, of course, for the Americans, too, to defend sort of the spread of that kind of militant insurgency towards Kabul. It was famous because in 2005 because it was the valley in which a SEAL team was pinned down. They were dropped there for an operation, pinned down. Significant, I think, three out of four, died. And then a helicopter sent in to try and get them out was shot down, and with all on board, I think 14 or 15 commandos were killed. So that happened in 2005, and the valley sort of got a reputation there. And now, as I said, it is the domain of two groups, really. I think usually in the media they try to lump them all together as one. I mean, it's called they lump them together as ACM, anti-coalition ACM. That's
yeah, anti-coalition militia.
Anti-coalition militia, but really it's two separate groups. It's the local Korangali or Afghan Taliban, and then you have foreign fighters, Arabs. And sometimes these two groups, you know, work together. They have the rough sort of same goals, but often they're separate. And that sort of relationship waxes and wanes, and the fortunes of the valley sort of, you know, go according with that, or the combat sort of goes according to that relationship.
You know, even the title of this article, you're British, Tim, not the first time that American forces that fighting forces, I mean, historically, whether you're speaking of the British or the Russians, now the Americans are challenged by that mountainous terrain. The Valley of Death, of course, refers to the British regiment lost there in the 19th century.
Well, absolutely. The historical imperative has been seen for a long time. I remember being at the border, the Pakistan-Afghan border in Peshawar back in 1993, and in those days, one could wander around quite freely there. And nowadays, obviously, that has totally changed.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the war in Afghanistan and the foot soldiers who are in nonstop combat. Those are American foot soldiers. I'm joined by writer Sebastian Younger and photographer and filmmaker Tim Hetherington. They've been reporting on Afghanistan for Vanity Fair. This installment is the January issue of the magazine, and they profile the trenches of the 2nd Platoon of Battle Company, 173rd Airborne Division. Tim, we were talking with you just before the break about the valleys of Afghanistan and how they have been graveyards, frankly, for numerous foreign regiments, starting with the
famous British. Absolutely. What's interesting as well is from European interest in Afghanistan that followed what was known as the Great Game, where Russia and the UK, France were looking at the importance, the strategic importance of Afghanistan for controlling Asia, and just recently, obviously, the Mujahideen jihad against the Soviets, supported by and backed by sort of American CIA plans, in which weapons were shipped to the Mujahideen, and the Soviets were beaten out of there, and now it's almost like the same tactics are being used again by forces there on the Americans, and it's like a chess game that just keeps on getting replayed and replayed.
Well, we'll hope that not with such disastrous consequences. And that's really what their story is all about. Would you take us into this chamber piece that you've done, where you do get to know these soldiers up close and personal, and you spent so much time with them? Sebastian, who are these men?
Well, they're professional soldiers. we no longer have a draft army as we did in Vietnam. And in fact, if you join the U.S. military, you pretty much have a choice. Do you want to be in combat or non-combat role? These guys are combat infantry, airborne infantry, and they're extremely proud of it. And so no one that I met there felt that the fact that they were in the Korangal Valley really represented any kind of personal misfortune in their life. They're very, very proud of the fact that they're really an elite in the U.S. military. I think something like 80% of the soldiers in Afghanistan, American soldiers in Afghanistan, never fire their weapons. These are the 20%, and those 20% fire their weapons a lot. The fighting is extremely intense. As I said before, when we were there in September at this remote outpost with 2nd Platoon, we were getting attacked 2-3 times a day, very intense firefights. There were bullets landing all around us. The Taliban were attacking from positions as close as 50 yards.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just thinking as you were speaking, you in the article describe leaving your little video camera running all the time so that you won't forget anything. And the firefights are constant. And you can see that even on the website of the video. Had you ever been shot at that much? And what happens to these soldiers when they're in this constant hail of fire, usually called firefights?
Well, I actually, in that particular situation, we knew we were going to get hit. We were out at a village in June. We got a radio communication that the Taliban literally had us in their gun sight. So I turned the video camera on because I didn't trust myself to remember to do that when the shooting started. And basically, we were hit in mid-stride as we were sprinting for cover. And I'm shooting video, and Tim is shooting video for ABC News. So that it was part of a sort of this other project we're doing. But the soldiers in those situations, I was just amazed. And I've gone over I have a lot of footage of firefights. I mean, we were in firefights all the time. And I've gone over it, and I'm just amazed. I mean, to the civilian, it looks very chaotic. I mean, a lot's going on. There's a lot of smoke. There's a lot of shouting. Everything's very, very loud. It's really chaotic. But in fact, there's a real sort of choreography between the men during a firefight. They each have a role. They each have a job. And they function very calmly and extremely effectively. And what I noticed was there's such a strong group affiliation between them that I never saw a man hesitate to expose himself to incoming fire when it was required of him to do, when he had to do that to do his job.
Let me ask you again. I think I'd like to know a little bit more. We obviously can't describe 20 or 30 individuals, but tell me a little bit about the company, the leader of the company, and some of the major people under the leader.
Oh, we're just sort of grabbing guys at random here.
I know you have affection for them all, but
yes, and they're all really extraordinary in
and
their
Tim's
own ways.
And them all, but
yeah, and I haven't even fully gotten to know them all. But just as I said, grabbing guys at random here. Lieutenant Piose, he's the platoon leader. He's from Pennsylvania. He's 24 years old. I'm 45, and I'm still adjusting to the fact that I'm 20 years older than these guys, and I also, because of the circumstances, I sort of look up to them almost as elders. They know what's going on. They know what to do, and I don't. And I look to them for reassurance. And in the case of Lieutenant Piosa, just an extremely calm, competent leader. The men respect him. He's very, very capable in firefights. I mean, I see him on the radio, and it's almost like you'd hardly know if you didn't hear the bang, bang, bang around you. You would never know he was in the middle of a firefight. You know, there's Sergeant Rice, Kevin Rice, wounded 3 times. He's eligible for a discharge. The last wound, he was shot in the stomach. Eligible for a discharge. He's refusing a discharge. He's insisting on going back to not only into Afghanistan but to Restrepo, to this outpost. No running water, no electricity, because he's so concerned about the welfare of his men. The captain has to order him off Restrepo every 2 weeks to take a hot shower and get a hot meal back at the firebase. And just incredibly dedicated soldiers.
Go ahead.
Well, and one final guy I'll mention, Anderson, a brilliant saxophone player. His mother is a jazz singer. They have cut albums together. Just an extraordinary young man. I could go on and on about these guys.
Well, one thing that surprised me is that you expected them to be homogenous, that especially since you've been in combat with soldiers before, they really have fascinating backgrounds, really diverse. I don't want to put words in your mouth. So tell me about the surprises in their backgrounds for you.
Well, Tim, as an Englishman, as a foreigner, might also have a sort of interesting take on this.
Well, let's let Tim go there.
Okay, there you go.
Well, it was interesting for me because it was my first time as well being embedded with U.S. forces, and really, you know, as somebody from the U.K. coming to the States, you kind of spend time in either East or West Coast, and you know, not very often getting sort of exposure to the sort of American heartland, and it was quite a pleasant surprise. I mean, this is the first time when I really was exposed to that American heartland. And in some ways, the work we're doing, it's about Afghanistan, but it's really about America. And, you know, being around these guys, you know, I sort of learned so much about them and their families and their ways of life and their beliefs. And, you know, it was incredibly, as you said, incredibly diverse. I mean, I don't think I expected it to be homogenized, but I just, the diversity of it was incredible.
Sebastian, you said that they reminded you of World War II soldiers and the things they did, digging trenches in the dark of night, building just about anything. Farm boys, some of them, one or two of them anyway, right?
Yeah, Sergeant Rice said that he grew up on a dairy farm and that none of the work that he has done building Restrepo, they moved, if I remember the numbers correctly, they shoveled and moved something like 10 tons of dirt over the course of a couple of months. Just real, as one guy said, this has basically, it looks like prison labor around the turn of the century. I mean, it really, they're just such hardworking guys. It's brutal, brutal work. Kevin Rice grew up doing work like that on the farm. I mean, they literally, you know, this is old-fashioned soldiering. This is fighting with a rifle and a shovel. I mean, they use the shovel to dig foxholes for themselves, and they get in the foxholes and they fight, and they sleep with hand grenades by their sides in case they get overrun. I mean, it is not what you're used to seeing on television in Iraq. I mean, this is not a war fought from the turret of a Humvee. This is on foot in just devastatingly brutal terrain. And, you know, frankly, it's a bit of a fair fight against these insurgents. They know the terrain very, very well. They're very tough guys. And the fighting is very, very intense.
We're getting a lot of questions from our listeners, and let's take a call. Nuruddin is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Nuruddin, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to make a few points. First of all, thank you very much for having programs like that, and I really like the title of this program, Forgotten War. And I wanted to make a comment about your guest's comments that this war is not about Afghanistan, it's about America. I think it is somehow about Afghanistan as well. And it should be about Afghanistan somehow. Because if we had thought Afghanistan should be somehow part of the solution in the world, we would not have had September 11 or all the crises we are having in Afghanistan and the poor kids who are fighting the wars in the valleys and the rocky mountains of Afghanistan.
Well, thank you, Nuruddin. Are you by any chance from Afghanistan?
I am from Afghanistan. I actually fled Afghanistan in 1999.
When the Taliban was there.
I grew up in war. I fought so many wars, unfortunately, either with ourselves or with foreigners. Before I let you go, I just want to say that we must not compare today's liberation of Afghanistan by multinationality to the occupation of Soviet Union or the British occupation of 1800. This is a different war. We are fighting to liberate Afghan people and bring decency.
So okay.
People must understand that.
Thank you very much. Tim, you were about to respond.
I was just going to say that absolutely the war is about Afghanistan. And what my point was that our story is really about is very much about America and Americans. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me in this war about Afghanistan, absolutely it's about that, is that, you know, why are American soldiers dying out there? What is the war achieving? And for me, often wars, you know, are fought to create nowadays that they're not necessarily won cut and dry. They're there to create a hiatus in which political dialogue takes place. And it just seems to me that Afghanistan is being kind of forgotten in terms of that political dialogue. And, you know, I wondered when I was out there seeing American soldiers and, you know, local people also dying, that why there isn't more sort of an emphasis on political dialogue.
Well,
and so I absolutely believe the war is about Afghanistan.
Well, what I want to say about that for both of you, Sebastian, why did you choose to focus on the American side of this? Having been there as much as you have, you could have presumably gone another way. We hear a little bit about the people of Korangal, the Korangalis. But this is, you are looking at American efforts here, and I guess they're hoping to avoid making the same mistakes the Russians did.
Yes, I mean, many times I've covered the sort of Afghan side of the Afghan story, starting, of course, in 96. And there are many fantastic journalists who are continuing to do that. It's a crucial part of this whole story. We can't, no individual reporter can do it all. And what I've decided to do is focus on this American platoon. And it's a very much an American experience. I mean, once you're in the sort of military bubble, frankly, I can't, you really don't leave it. I mean, frankly, I can't go wandering out of the outpost to go talk to the people in the nearby village. I'll be shot.
They did try to talk to elders whenever they had the chance, though. You have that vividly described.
Well, of course. I mean, the American troops move in patrols, well-armed patrols, everywhere they go. And we've been in villages and talked to the elders. The elder in one village invited us in for tea. He was a very, very friendly guy. And of course, as soon as we left the village, we were ambushed by guys on a mountainside who'd been tracking our movements. So there is interaction with locals, and for the most part, what I've seen, it's somewhat sometimes contentious, but for the most part, always respectful and usually quite friendly. But to do that by my, you know, basically I'm there by the side of an armed American soldier. That's not how you'd prefer to interview a local Afghan. Mm-hmm. And as I said, you know, going into the village by myself without the soldiers would literally be suicide.
Right.
Not that the villagers would kill me, but there are guys on the mountainsides who would.
You have a portrait here of one of these soldiers, Tim Hetherington. I think this is Matt Piosa. For me, it was the most affecting. He's looking right at the camera. His brow is furrowed. He looks as if he may not know quite where he is. I wondered what the circumstances of this portrait were.
I forget exactly. I mean, as you know, portraits are, I mean, one takes a lot of pictures, thousands of pictures. I mean, and the resultant sort of images that put together are a very tight edit of those thousands of pictures, and also filming. I mean, you know, we're doing a lot of work out there, so I can't exactly remember the circumstances. It was just, I think, a moment in Restrepo bunker, and we were there, and I just suddenly asked him, you know, to just look at the camera, and I took the picture.
And Restrepo is named for a man who was lost, right?
Restrepo is named after a medic that was killed there. You know, they're taking about casualty rates of about 20%, both injured or killed. So, you know, they're on a recent combat operation. You know, battle company had lost three dead and six wounded, and then recently on I think it was the 9th of November, they took a horrendous casualties in just over the border in the province of Nuristan, in which I think it was six died and eight were wounded following a meeting, a shura with elders. When they left the village, they were ambushed. So the casualty rates in Afghanistan, you know, are fairly significant. And
in fact, and you broke your leg, didn't you?
I broke my leg, yeah, on the last combat operation. But the casualty rates are significant, and I think that relating that back to the image of Matt Piosa in the bunker, I mean, you know, it's an incredibly charged and emotional atmosphere. And so I think that the image, perhaps something of that does come through, because there is a sort of a vulnerability to us all out there. And in the end, you cannot help but just be honest, that this sort of honesty is around. And I think that that does transfer to both film and to photographs.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Afghanistan, a war that is often overshadowed by the war in Iraq. And joining me from New York are author and journalist Sebastian Younger. He's been writing about Afghanistan for years, and in the January issue of Vanity Fair, he takes us into the treacherous trenches of Afghanistan's Korangal Valley. And joining me also is photographer and filmmaker Tim Hetherington. He photographed that story for Vanity Fair, and he filmed it for ABC News. Gentlemen, I'd like to take a caller first. Peter is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, welcome to On Point.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. See, what I think about Afghanistan, I'm a Russian myself. I was in army at the time, but not Afghanistan, different part of the world, in Germany. But I know a lot of friends who served in Afghanistan. It was completely different.
You know many friends who served in the Russian army in Afghanistan.
Yes,
Russian.
So basically what I think a lot of to say, I know I have to be specific, but first of all, when Russia went to Afghanistan, America and Western power are very much opposed this. Not even opposed, they started helping Afghanistan. It's Taliban, if I remember, correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, started arming the Mujahideen.
Yeah, three countries recognized Taliban, U.S., Pakistan, and I don't know, something else. So basically, it was huge pressure for Russia. And basically, if jump ahead, if Russia could, it wasn't much pressure. Russia could.
And your point, Peter, is.
Yeah, basically, what? will be easy right now for U.S. U.S. shouldn't have a casualty from Afghanistan. And Russian soldier was killed by American weapons. We know all of this. And probably will be more normal life in Afghanistan.
Are you saying that American soldiers should leave Afghanistan to avoid the mistakes the Russians made?
Well, it's hard for me. Well, it's a lot of to say. You know, right now, after September 11, of course, well, America should punish someone, I know, like superpower. But what I'm trying to be clear, if wasn't much pressure from U.S., from Western power to Russians at the time, 1978 was 80, even Olympic, even civil life was convicted. America boycotted Olympic Games, you remember, 1980.
All right.
So basically, this mistake, now America paying for this. I'm sorry, it's every soldier dying over there, it's a bad thing, but... You know, America is politics.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Peter. Did you see amongst the soldiers, Sebastian and Tim, you said you didn't see a lot of bitterness about being there, that for some guys it had been jail or the military, but that was just one guy, and others had volunteered and said, if not me, who, right? I mean, they believed in the mission.
There are different motivations for joining the military for these guys. A lot of them joined because there was a history of joining the military in their families. Their fathers have been in the military.
That's always true.
That's always true. Well, just about everything about these guys, I think, has always been true. Some joined out of a sense of patriotism. A couple of guys were given the choice of prison or the Army. They chose the Army, and both made a point of telling me it was the best thing that could have happened to them. And again, these guys are extremely proud of being a combat infantry unit. They're very, very highly trained and very, very proud of it. No one seemed to... I mean, they complain about... I mean, life is hard at Restrepo, but they don't complain about their fate. They complain about the hardships.
Well, the description you have of trying to take a summit... And they're crawling up, and the only way they can do that at night, since there's no cover. I'm sorry, it's the only way they can do that is to travel at night, since there's no cover. And then they have to dig the trenches with the shovels on their back, take cover before daylight comes up, make sandbags out of rock bags. What do they call them? They had a comic name for them.
Well, sandbags are supposed to be filled with sand, which is fairly easy to shovel. There's no sand up there. It's all rock shelf. So they'd break the rock up with pickaxes and then fill the bags with what they call – they made them into what they called rock bags. This was when they were building Restrepo. They went up there at night precisely to avoid the gunfire that they knew would come during the day. And they dug furiously all night, so they had a sort of minimum amount of protection. They kept working. The sun rose. They kept working. They immediately started taking fire. They lay down. The firefights were their chance to take a break. Now, keep in mind, it's 100 degrees, 110 degrees. They're in body armor in the full sun. The firefights were a chance to take a rest. They'd lie down. They'd return fire until the firefight stopped. They'd get up, keep working. Sometimes they were so badly pinned down, they were literally lying behind sandbags under fire, picking rocks up and throwing them over their heads into the HESCO containers that form part of the fortifications, because there was just nothing else they could do.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to think that the rest they got sometimes was lying on their backs during a firefight. Let's take a call from Stefan, who's calling from West Springfield, Massachusetts. Hello, Stefan. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, thank you.
And Stefan?
Yeah, I'm calling because, I served in Afghanistan. I just got back 6 months ago. I was an embedded trainer. I worked alongside the Afghan National Army. And I do think, unfortunately, that Afghanistan is extremely overshadowed by Iraq. A lot of what we did and where we went and a lot of the progress you see being made there is never discussed. And at least as far as in the American press, there's a lot of coverage in the Canadian press and a lot of the European press because of the involvement of ISAF. But American press doesn't get involved nearly enough.
Did you feel that at the time?
Oh, yeah. Yes, very much so. To pull up information as far as operations going on or improvements and progress being made there, it was a lot easier to read Canadian or European news sources versus American news sources.
Thank you very much for that comment, Stefan. Let me ask you about telling people about this, telling people about it through the printed word and the photographic image. A cynic could look at this piece. I've been in war zones, so, I mean, I look at it and I understand what's maybe behind the guy with the rifle. But most people haven't, and most people aren't going to be this up close to combat. They're striking images, but they are also lovely. Sebastian, you're telegenic. These photos are transporting. Do you ever come under the criticism that, especially in a glossy magazine, that somehow this has been too perfectly packaged, too pretty?
That's a tough one to answer. I mean, I'm not the photographer. I think I'll
well, then let's have Tim answer it.
Yeah, I think maybe Tim should answer, talk about the photos a bit.
Well, I think that in terms of the, you know, both photography and film and visual is an aesthetic medium. And, you know, whether you make pretty pictures or not pretty pictures, that's still an aesthetic strategy. So that kind of argument is a part of it, you know, is beside the point. I mean, what we've done here is create a kind of a strategy for communicating, you know, to as wide a public as possible. And, you know, we could have spent our time doing very complex sort of political analysis of Afghanistan, and there are many people that are doing that. But what we wanted to do was we wanted to connect with as wide an audience as possible and get this sort of what is going on in Afghanistan on the agenda. And I think by focusing on sort of a platoon of soldiers, really getting to know them, you know, and sort of we're able to access a much wider territory of people out there. And in some ways, you know, it's like Vanity Fair did the Africa issue and got a lot of criticism for it. But at the end of the day, I think it was fantastic that a magazine like Vanity Fair took on sort of a subject matter like that rather than sort of just having endless fashion spreads.
Did you get the pictures into the magazine that you wanted to get in? Are these the photos that did you get to choose your top 20 or whatever?
Yeah, of course. One like in either a magazine or on television, one is involved in the edit, and so that the product represents what you want. I mean, obviously, you know, if one is a perfectionist, then you want much more. You want the whole magazine to be about Afghanistan. That's never going to happen. So there's a certain amount of compromise. But I think at the end of the day, you know, we got the viewing figures back for ABC the other day, and it was 22 million. And I was thinking, you know, even if two-thirds of that, those people are making a cup of coffee and not watching or feeding their dog and not watching the TV set, that's still 7 million, which is more significant than a 40,000 print run magazine in Europe. So, you know, and the very fact that we're on this radio show shows that the strategy that we've been working is being successful.
Were there any photographs that were too gory that you decided to exclude?
I tried to put together both images on TV and photographs that I think will successfully convey what is happening out there. And you know, the representation of pain and suffering is a long debated subject within the documentary community and outside of it. And sometimes, you know, of course, there are images that are extremely upsetting. But if again, on the ABC footage, I think there's a scene where during the last combat operation, the Taliban broke through our line, or the lines where we were with the Americans. They shot dead one particular soldier at a range of 10 feet, killed two others, and I ran up there with wounded two others. I ran up there with a group of soldiers as a counterattack, and we found a terrible scene of soldiers who had just been overrun, incredibly upset, in a state of shock. And in fact, that scene, and we showed it on ABC, was more powerful than showing a dead soldier. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, those things in certain ways are just not constructive.
The tension and, you know, on the face. And one of the most effective pictures, I think, is where one of the someone is calling in positions, a spotter is calling in positions to the gunners, and he's screaming, and you really feel like you're right beside him. I want to take a call from Charles, who's calling from Blauvelt, New York. Hello, Charles.
Hi. My question, I'm an ex-platoon leader, and I was wondering how these guys are living. Are they living in tents? How are they resupplied as far as their ammunition? Do they have any water? Do they get a bath now and then? This type of thing.
And where were you a platoon leader, Charles?
I was a platoon leader in Korea. A long time ago.
Do you feel like that's a forgotten war?
Yes, of course I do. Right. But more important is how these guys, I was a platoon leader, and how these guys are being resupplied and taken care of up there on the front line.
Sebastian, you write a lot about that.
Yeah, it is rough out there. When we were there, they were sleeping in the open on cots or on the ground. They were resupplied by helicopter. The helicopter would come in low and just cut loose a sling load of water and MREs, and they got ammunition in there by helicopter as well. I don't think they dropped it, but And they were allowed to go back to the firebase. And, you know, the firebase is it's where they land the helicopters, where the captain is. That would be considered a hardship posting, I think, by almost anyone in the U.S. military. Very, very rough place. That's Paris compared to Restrepo. So the guys at Restrepo are allowed to go back to the firebase every couple of weeks to get a hot shower and a hot meal. Out at Restrepo, they have no running water, they have no electricity, they have no hot meals, they have no communication with home, they have no internet, they have absolutely nothing except MREs and ammunition.
Sebastian, we haven't talked about the tension and what it's doing to these guys. You say that a lot of them do have nightmares. Do you think half the platoon perhaps has PTSD? They sort of don't want to leave it. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not sure I could diagnose PTSD, but I do know they talk about the effects of combat. You know, frankly, anyone in combat is affected by it. I come home and I have nightmares for a little while and they go away. I mean, that's a very normal, healthy reaction to any trauma, you know, including, for example, a car accident. It's just how people deal with upsetting things. But these guys would talk. One guy complained that he kept jumping out of his sleeping bag at night, crawling around on his hands and knees, looking for a hand grenade that he had dreamt someone had thrown at him. He wanted to throw it back and kill the guy, and he kept doing that night after night. They also talk a little bit about how hard it is to talk to their families back home. They're experiencing such an intense and different reality in Afghanistan, and they call home to their parents or to their wives or girlfriends. They're desperate to talk to them, but they also find that they don't have much to say. And it's I think that experience happens when they go home as well. And I think psychologically, that's one of the hardest things. The hardest things for them is that sort of almost unbridgeable gap between their experience and the experience of the people they love.
Well, let's take a quick call. Laura is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Hello, Laura. Just quickly.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm so glad you're having this conversation. Our son is completing his second tour in Afghanistan. It'll be his fourth tour since he joined in 99. But what you just said about soldiers calling home and not really having anything to talk about is very, very true. And I think that just speaks to how the experience in either Afghanistan or Iraq is so disconnected from what we experience on a daily basis in the United States. But I'm so grateful that you're having this conversation, because I do believe that the struggle to hold on to Afghanistan for the Afghani people is one that gets lost in the rhetoric of what's going on in Iraq. We'll take your comment off the air, but I just wanted to throw that in as my own comment to your discussion.
Thanks for calling in, Laura. In just a couple of minutes that we've got left, Sebastian and Tim, you were really both impressed with something that sometimes we feel in our prefab culture gets lost, and war fighting can bring it back. And that was there's a kind of a can-do spirit that went right along with the patriotism. That really came through loud and clear in the pictures and film and your words, their words.
I think that's true of any any army. The men who
fight
war.
Do they think that they can succeed? Do they think this war is going to be won?
You know, they don't really think about it. That's not their job is to bring peace and stability to the Korangal Valley, and individually to survive their efforts to do that. That's their job. They really don't, and I think shouldn't, think about the broader picture. Frankly, it would take their mind off of what they're doing, and that could be very, very dangerous. That's not the role of an infantry soldier.
Tim Hetherington, can wars like this be won?
That's a larger question for debate. I spend a lot of time covering wars in Africa, and I've noticed that recently, increasingly, wars are not won. They're in the end, there's a sort of a negotiated settlement. Sometimes in Afghanistan, what I saw, it's kind of difficult to think that you can have an outright war. I mean, you need to have, the solution is in sort of political compromise, Karzai government, American involvement there, and that needs to take place
with more concentrated
effort.
Well, thank you for making us think more intently about something often forgotten. Tim Hetherington, Sebastian Younger,
filmmaker and photographer and writer, did an assignment for ABC and Vanity Fair. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.